The U.S. Senate early and absentee vote count gets underway in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 9th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, changes in State House leadership for the next legislative session.
Because I've gone up a notch, and because Kyle is no longer there, that kind of balances out a little bit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
The Division of Elections is counting the first round of absentee and early votes today. APRN's Dave Donaldson has some early returns, but there are a lot of votes still to be tabulated.
So far, Republican nominee Joe Miller has picked up 1,221 votes over the total number of write-in votes cast last week. Most of those are expected to be for incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski. When they began this morning, the Division of Elections had a total of about 30,000 votes to count and another 12,000 challenged ballots to go through. The numbers so far show 88,044 write-in votes in the Senate election. Miller himself has 75,826 votes. Put into perspective, that means he's gained about 1% of the total number of votes cast in the race. As of airtime, no results were in from votes cast in Southeast, Kenai, or Fairbanks. The count of the write-in ballots will begin in Juneau tomorrow morning. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
As Division of Elections officials oversee the count of absentee early and question ballots over the next several days, the specter of voter fraud in an election that saw record numbers of early voting is a concern. Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai says election officials have a system in place to ensure that those who vote early can't vote again. Fanumiai says if you vote early, you're automatically given voter history in the registration system and names are crossed off precinct lists.
For absentee by mail and in-person and question voting, we do a duplicate voter check. We get the precinct registers back from all 438 precincts and do what we call in-person election day voter history. And then when our staff goes in to log ballots and when the review boards go in to review the ballots, they know if somebody already voted in person in another form, and we're able to catch duplicate voting in that manner.
And how much has there been of that sort of shenanigans going on? Have you caught people engaged in that sort of voter fraud?
Well, there have been, you know, instances when, you know, in the, I believe in 2008 primary, there was over 30 people who voted more than once in the primary election. And I don't have the numbers for the general, and we're still... The numbers from the primary, I don't remember what they were from this year either, but there are people that do it. Generally, most instances are case of the elderly. They might have forgotten they got a by-mail ballot, went to their polling place and voted, and we haven't really seen any malicious voters out there who are actually trying to go out and fraudulently vote and defraud the system. But it is a check we feel is important because, you know, it is one voter, one vote. Alaska has had close races, so that's we take that very seriously.
And if an elder, someone with handicaps, wants to vote at home, who gets the ballot for them? Who witnesses the actual vote to make sure that that person is the one that fills in the ballot that's intended for them?
Well, that can happen in a couple ways. A family member can come to a regional elections office, to a voting station and pick up a ballot, and it's called our special needs voting process. They can go to a precinct on election day and get a ballot for a family member. There also are organizations who will provide that kind of service. League of Women Voters does it in some communities. We do provide notices at the hospitals that if people are there on election day and want a ballot, we do have temporary election officials that provide that service to people as well. And they are the witness that person is who they say they are. They get ID. They witness that person actually signs the envelope and is the one that voted that ballot.
Gail Fanumiai is the director of the State Division of Elections. Public television will let you watch the count of the write-in votes in the race for the U.S. Senate on your TV or computer. KTOO Television in Juneau provides the live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the legislative session, along with other public affairs programming statewide. And beginning tomorrow, Bill Legere, the station's president and general manager, says the service will offer a live, continuous video coverage of the vote-counting process in Juneau.
Just like gavel to gavel, it'll be just a camera in the room and like a fly on the wall, providing the eyes and ears of people who can't be there. So there will be no commentary, no cutaways. It'll just be continuous coverage for as long as the write-in count goes.
Legere says the service is part of the ongoing philosophy of gavel to gavel to show people things they would not ordinarily be able to see. He says the only people that will be allowed into the building are elections officials, recognized observers, and the media. The services will be available on cable channels that provide gavel to gavel during the legislative session and the 360 North channel during the rest of the year. It will also be available on the internet at 360north.org. Governor Parnell will replace nearly half of the cabinet-level people that met him when Sarah Palin resigned last year. Parnell announced last week that he had asked for resignations from all commissioners and other high-level appointed officials, and so far he has accepted those resignations from Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin, Natural Resources Commissioner Tom Irwin, Administration Commissioner Annette Kreitzer, Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Hogan, Education Commissioner Larry Ledoux, and Transportation Commissioner Leo Von Shaven. The resignation of Deputy Natural Resources Commissioner Marty Rutherford was also accepted. His spokesperson, Sharon Lehow, says the commissioners will all remain in office until the governor appoints his own administration next month.
As the governor said last week, he took a close look at his commissioners and the agencies. And, you know, with every new administration, there are changes. And, you know, the governor has opted to keep some of his commissioners and, you know, others are moving on. And he's looking forward to his new team.
Lehow says the rest of the cabinet will remain in place for his administration. He plans to have jobs filled by his inauguration. However, if any position is still vacant, he will appoint someone to temporarily fill it. Lehow says the governor will have letters of resignation by the end of the week from agency heads and sub-cabinet appointees. However, there is no indication of which of those individuals will be replaced. The governor will take the oath of office in Juneau on December 6th. One of the most powerful members of Alaska's House of Representatives has left the Republican-led majority caucus. Ketchikan's Kyle Johansson walked out of an organizational meeting last weekend that kept Kenai's Mike Chenault as Speaker of the House. Johansson left after another GOP representative, Anchorage's Cherise Millett, was denied a committee assignment she had sought. The two lawmakers have been described as having a close personal relationship. While Johansson lost a significant post, two other Southeast lawmakers, Bill Thomas and Peggy Wilson, moved into new leadership roles. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
Ketchikan Republican Kyle Johansson has been House Majority Leader for the past 2 years. That made him second in charge of the chamber's ruling coalition and floor leader. The new majority, just organized under current Speaker Mike Chenault of Kenai, offered Johansson the same post. But according to caucus member Peggy Wilson, he wanted changes in committee assignments. She says Johansson issued an ultimatum, she would not reveal the details, and left. So the group's remaining 23 Republicans and their three Democratic allies voted Kodiak's Alan Osterman into the majority leader's post. And Johansson was left outside the caucus. So was Anchorage Representative Cherise Millett, who also wanted committee assignment changes. Johansson could not be reached for immediate comment. Wilson, a Wrangell Republican, took over as Majority Whip, the person who chairs caucus meetings and focuses on group goals.
Because I've gone up a notch, And because Kyle is no longer there, that kind of balances out a little bit.
Wilson will also continue to chair the Transportation Committee. Haines Republican Bill Thomas moves up a notch on the House Finance Committee, becoming co-chairman in charge of the operating budget.
I think people want to see a tighter budget, and I think we're going to try to keep the growth down, but still try to meet some of the needs, demand.
Thomas says he's not ready to project a spending level for next year. He says he's looking forward to meeting with Senate leaders and the governor's budget staff.
We have to see what the price of oil is and what we can sustain here as a state without going overboard.
Juneau Democrat Beth Curtula will continue to lead her party's minority caucus, as she has done for the past 4 years. Election losses have dropped its size to 12 members, but Curtula says it still holds power.
I'm the point person that deals with the Speaker and with the, the Senate. So I'm in a good spot to help not only my district, but help set policy for the state.
She says she has not heard from minority Republicans Johansson and Millett about joining her organization, but she doubts that will happen.
I think philosophically that that's not what they want, but I'm always open to talking with people and seeing what would work best.
Elsewhere in the House majority, Chugiak Matsu Republican Bill Stoltz remains as Finance Committee co-chair for the capital budget. He replaces Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker, who will chair the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And Anchorage Republican Craig Johnson becomes Rules Committee chairman. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dangerous ice on the Kuskokwim River.
There must be 20 or 30 holes. Some of them are huge, huge holes that are still open.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The village of Newtok suffered a great loss over the weekend. A father and two of his sons are reported dead after their snow machine fell through the ice near Newtok on Saturday. Alaska State Troopers are reporting the deceased as George Irvak Sr., age 67, and his sons George Irvak Jr., age 11, and Teddy Irvak, age 9. It was originally reported that they were going to set blackfish traps, but Bethel Search and Rescue says that the blackfish traps were left at home. They think it's more likely that they were checking the trail, but they didn't get far. The pond they fell through was near the village's airport and within sight of some of the homes. There was new snow on the ground that covered their tracks, but the machine was pointing away from the village, indicating that the trio was still leaving the village. Bethel Search and Rescue says the pond is man-made and approximately 14 feet deep. They say ice was thin where the snow machine broke through. Newtok is located near the Bering Sea, about 100 miles west of Bethel. The three left the village on Saturday morning. After they failed to return, a search and rescue mission was initialized that day. That included local volunteers along with air support from the troopers and Civil Air Patrol. Ground searchers located their submerged snow machine the next day on Sunday afternoon at about 12:30. Volunteer teams from Kwithluk, Napuskiuk, and Bethel assisted. They were able to drag the pond and retrieve all three bodies. Drowning is the likely cause of death, but an autopsy will be performed by the state medical examiner's office. Alcohol does not appear to be a factor. Meanwhile, the main transportation corridor in and out of Bethel is extremely dangerous right now. That's the word from search and rescue members concerned that a slow freeze-up on the Kuskokwim River is tempting travelers to push their luck. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Ice has been forming in front of Bethel since last week, and from the seawall it can look strong enough to travel over. But not so, says pilot Earl Samuelson.
There must be 20 or 30 holes. Some of them are huge, huge holes that are still open.
Samuelson flies for the Alaska State Troopers, and he conducts aerial surveys of the river during breakups and freeze-ups. He just flew over the Kuskokwim and was disturbed by what he saw.
Noticed there was somebody coming out of Bethel going across the island between huge Huge holes over there.
Samuelson reports that there are several snow machine tracks running near deadly areas. With no road to connect communities, the river is the main link between villages and to goods and services in Bethel. Bethel Search and Rescue President Peter Atchek says this year the area is experiencing a freeze-up that defies conventional wisdom. Atchek says the jumbled and jagged ice forming on top of the river is not what it looks to be.
Rough ice is usually safer ice to cross on, you know, but not this year.
Part of the problem is that below freezing conditions have persisted for weeks, but a deep cold is yet to solidify the water. And Atchek says some other conditions are at play.
Just when it was freezing up and the ice was all jammed up, you know, rough ice, there was some snow involved. And then that kind of mixed with the water, which creates, you know, air pockets.
Bethel Search and Rescue is cautioning all travelers in Bethel and surrounding villages to stay off the river until a cold snap can truly turn the river into an ice road. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Three men charged in connection with the torture killing in Bethel pleaded not guilty in court yesterday. Defendants Jeff Hout, age 46, and Harry Ned Williams, age 32, appeared at their arraignment shackled together and wearing yellow jumpsuits. Hout and Williams are both facing charges of murder in the first degree and murder in the second for the death of 19-year-old Benjamin Kaiser of Hooper Bay. Williams was found... Kaiser... was found dead and beaten at Hout's residence on October 27th. Hout and Williams have also been charged with kidnapping and tampering with evidence, both felony crimes. In court, Williams was represented by a public defender from Anchorage. Hout had no legal representation at the arraignment. He entered his own plea of not guilty. He was previously represented by a private firm, but that arrangement is no longer in place. Hout told the judge he plans on filing paperwork to obtain a court-ordered attorney, but he said he's waiting for his mother to provide him with his financial information. Hout told the judge his mother takes care of his finances. A third defendant, David Kenny, age 37, was present by phone. His lawyer, who was also on the phone, said that Kenny was currently hospitalized but did not explain further. Kenny entered a not guilty plea for charges of hindering a prosecution and tampering with evidence. Those are both felony charges. The judge for the case is Michael McConaughey of Fairbanks Superior Court. McConaughey says he will conduct much of the proceedings telephonically, but he also said he will come to Bethel for the trial itself. He scheduled the trial to begin the last week of January.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Four people have been killed in a house fire near Caswell. Alaska State Troopers say the home about 55 miles north of Anchorage was engulfed in flames when they arrived just before 6 a.m. this morning. A passerby noticed flames at the home at mile 87 of the park's highway and reported the fire. Several fire crews from surrounding towns responded to the blaze. Additional details were not immediately available. Troopers, the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, and the State Fire Marshal's Office are investigating. A record-setting pink salmon harvest in Prince William Sound and rebounding prices at the docks around Alaska helped propel the value of the 2010 salmon catch to its highest level in nearly two decades. Statewide, the salmon harvest dropped 168 million, topped 168 million fish, up more than 5 million from last year. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it's the 11th largest salmon harvest since statehood. Fish and Game Assistant Director Jaron Bruce says the value of this year's catch reached historic levels.
It was the first time since 1992 that the excessive value of the Alaska salmon fishery statewide exceeded $500 million. That's half a billion dollars. So first time in 18 years we've been up there. In that level, this is the upper echelon of salmon value to the fishermen. And there are only four other years where we've been up, four other years besides this year when we've been up there since 1975.
Statewide, fishing fleets landed more than 105 million pink salmon in 2010. A record 69 million pinks were caught in Prince William Sound, with the bulk of those fish returning to hatcheries. In Bristol Bay, this year's catch of more than 28 million sockeye salmon were worth nearly $149 million at the docks. Those two catches made up more than half of the total value of this year's salmon harvest statewide. In Southeast, the pink salmon catch ended up topping 24 million, worth around $31 million at the docks. Southeast fishermen caught almost 9.5 million chum with an average price of 72 cents a pound and a total worth of more than $56 million. Most of those chum are produced by the region's hatcheries, and chums remain by far the most valuable of the five salmon species in the panhandle. Bruce says prices for chum and pinks were notable this year.
The chum prices and the pink prices, I guess, are the thing that are most impressive to me about Southeast Alaska. Chums is on average price per pound region-wide are back up in the 70, at 72 cents is what we have for an average, and then 30 for the pinks. So these are some pretty good prices compared to recent times. But if you were to go back to the, you know, to the 80s, you would find prices at the same level. So, you know, if you were to adjust them for inflation, they're not going to look as good as they do in terms of nominal dollars.
Salmon prices have been on the rise since a low point in 2002. As for other species, Southeast permit holders caught 2.5 million coho with an average price of $1.19 per pound. Southeast's king salmon catch was 249,000 fish, and the sockeye harvest was 717,000. Elsewhere around the state, 2010 was a poor pink salmon year along the Alaska Peninsula. The catch was 867,000 humpies from a preseason forecast of 5.8 million. It was also another poor year on the Yukon River for fall chum and king salmon. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has requested the recall of a batch of smoked salmon from a Fairbanks producer after it found a shipment contained a pathogen. The department has targeted half-pound bags of Santa's Smokehouse Cajun-style smoked Keta salmon sold between August 27th and November 6th. The department found the bacterium Listeria in a batch sold at the company's retail stores. The Santa Smokehouse brand is produced by Interior Alaska Fish Processors. No illnesses have been reported in association with the recall. The Department of Environmental Conservation has not yet identified the source of the contamination. The most serious acoustic threat to the ocean's cetacean populations may be the noise from commercial shipping rather than the more controversial use of powerful naval sonar. That's the contention of Dr. Roger Gentry, a former researcher at the National Marine Fisheries Service. Gentry is now a private consultant and one of eight scientists presenting their work at this year's Whale Fest in Sitka. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Gentry made it clear, though, that naval sonar is a lethal hazard for whales and dolphins. In 1996, a dozen Cuvier's beaked whales were killed by a sonar operation near Greece. 4 years later, the U.S. Navy reported the death of nine beaked whales from the use of sonar in the Bahamas. But Gentry also pointed out that naval sonar represents a tiny fraction of the man-made acoustic energy generated in the oceans. He said offshore petroleum development creates a considerably larger share of noise than the military.
Geophysical exploration by oil and gas companies for reserves at sea. The way they make noise is they have these large stainless steel tubes. They put compressed air inside them and they release that air all at once, and it makes a loud thudding sound, very loud. And there are like 30 or 40 guns in an array that all go off at the same time. Those arrays also have the capability of killing animals and of altering their behavior.
The combination of military sounds, geophysical exploration, and natural sounds made by wind and waves, and even other whales, still represents less than a quarter of the noise present in the oceans. Gentry said the remainder was produced by ships.
There are something like 80,000 large commercial vessels operating worldwide. These are the largest ones, not the small ones. And their engines are going bank to bank, and their propellers are cavitating out there, and they make this noise that is continuous. And this has far more capability of masking communication calls than any other.
Outside of commercial fishing bycatch, which kills an estimated 300,000 cetaceans a year, it is acoustic masking that may be the greatest threat to whales and dolphins. Masking blocks both communication calls and echolocation, which cetaceans use to find food. Masking may lie behind the 41 documented mass strandings of marine mammals since 1960. Gentry described two experiments designed to study the dose response of whales to controlled sound, one off the coast of Australia and one in Southern California. In the California experiment, whales were tagged to allow researchers to record their movements underwater. Gentry said that even when exposed to mild sounds, Cuvier's beaked whales abandoned their feeding patterns. Gentry said it's not damage to the ear that causes whales to go ashore.
Instead, it's much more likely that the animal hears the sound, makes some kind of a really unfavorable and unwise behavioral decision, and its behavior somehow affects its tissues, causes it to strand.
Although cochlear tissue is among the most delicate in mammals, Gentry said that stranded whales typically do not have ear injuries. Instead, they'll have brain hemorrhages, which suggest rapid surfacing. The cetaceans that are killed by intense sound have to be very close, within a kilometer of the source. Gentry said that the two acoustic experiments conducted so far cost about $7 million each, with funding from the petroleum industry and the U.S. military. There were about 250 people in the audience for his Whale Fest presentation, including high school students from as far away as Barrow. Gentry said that despite this high-profile research and some spectacular failures, scientists still knew very little about cetaceans and sound. "We need more help and more researchers," he said. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Cook Inlet Region Corporation has asked the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce to pressure utilities to support its planned Fire Island Wind Farm project. K2UU reports the Native Corporation has already spent $9 million and begun clearing land on Fire Island to build 33 turbines. To get federal stimulus money for the project, the corporation needs agreements from utilities to buy the power. Those contracts must be approved by state regulators by March. The corporation says it's negotiating with utilities and working on ways to integrate the variable wind power with electricity generated by natural gas. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
The Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Spring semester starts January 20th. Information at distance.uaf.edu. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.